Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is the second show that I've done since I have returned to the air. The last show I did, the last lecture I put out was, I believe, in June of 2012. And appropriately enough, it was on the last patriarch of Russia before the 20th century, Patriarch Adrian, who was never replaced. And that radically altered Russian history quite a bit, because the church was then mangled and purged by Peter in a way not too dissimilar to the Bolsheviks. That is not my topic, but I think there's something appropriate to that being the very last podcast. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, the senior researcher for the Barnes Review. I'm extremely proud of not only that title, but that publication. I've been a part of the Barnes Review in my entire career is based on it. Right out of grad school, I had sent a CV to Willis Cardo in Washington, and I believe it was Mike Piper who was very interested in making room for me. And I became the associate editor and then the editor of the Barnes Review. And I had that job until the company went bankrupt, I believe in 2005. And from there, I became a professor of history at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland. I left there sometime later, and then was always from there on in associated with the Barnes Review in one way or another. And it's been very important to me. I believe in that publication and what it stands for. It publishes academic articles at its best that aren't published anywhere else. And what I mean by that is that places are simply too scared to publish these things. It's not a matter of the articles being good or bad. It's just that it won't be. It's not allowed to be published. So I have spent my adult life, my career, either in academia or having some association with the Barnes Review. And of course, also then almost by definition, the Spotlight and the American Free Press. And now in practice, the Barnes Review is a journal of nationalism, especially when it comes to German and Russian variants of it. The anti-British point of view, that is to say, the anti-imperialist attitude really seems to be the defining concept of the Barnes Review, at least politically speaking. And Willis Cardo took a chance on me. I was an unknown entity at the time, but clearly very much in tune with the mentality there. And as you know, Willis Cardo died last year, and it was a huge loss. It was a huge loss for nationalism. It was a huge loss for publishing. And it was a huge loss for me personally. Because despite Willis's reputation, he was a very kind and decent man. When my children were born, for example, he gave me extra time off to spend time with them. He's not known for that sort of thing, but for those of us who knew him personally and knew him professionally, that was the case. And all sorts of things like that he had done for me over the years. And I always remember him and always defend his legacy and defend his honor. I have a my obituary for Willis that I wrote a day after I found that he died, and I will publish that soon. These days now, one of my duties is that I've taken over gladly the blog of the Barnes Review online. Willis Cardo never learned how to use a computer. He wouldn't know what a blog was. But now that the organization is being reorganized, Chris Bethrick, Paul Angel, and myself are involved in that, and that's really a big deal because the three of us have known each other for a very long time. Chris Bethrick and I were hired at the same time, and we have known each other and have worked together for that for a long period of time, and we trust each other. And this is very important. We're organizing Willis's work and continuing in his footsteps, but we're bringing it into the 21st century. And all three of us are technically competent and proficient, and things are changing in a very, very good way. But nothing is being done outside of what Willis would have wanted. And I know that extremely well, because I cannot count the number of times that Willis and I spoke on substantial policy issues. I came out of grad school also having taught there at the University of Nebraska, and I ended up there really because I got a fellowship from Warren Buffett. The University of Nebraska, of course, he's his most famous alumnus, and he liked the idea of increasing the enrollment in graduate education there, offering fellowships to the best and brightest around the country. It's a shame that Nebraska is not really known for academia as it should be, because there was always a lot of big names there, and a lot of big names are coming out of there and teach there. And the money has been provided, among other areas, by Warren Buffett. And he had them under various names, made-up names. I've met him more than once, and he basically said that you know, he something come across his desk, someone says that there's a promising person somewhere, and he offers a fellowship, especially in the sciences. The largest genetics research laboratory in the world, for example, is at the Lincoln campus of the University of Nebraska, the Beatles Center. And I was living in Lincoln at the time. I had just got married. And Willis Cardo and Mike Piper were very interested in meeting me. And I moved to D.C. and I moved to Reston, Virginia. And the rest is history. And it's very important to me that you know my association with Willis Cardo and how I will always and continue to defend his legacy. How many people took advantage of his kindness and his generosity. He's known as being a difficult man and a hard man, and to some extent that is true. But that has to be balanced by another view of him that shows him as being very generous and very kind for people that he respects. And Willis Cardo and I fought quite a bit over policy issues. One day he came into the office and he said, "I want you to do a paper basically arguing that Adolf Hitler and Thomas Jefferson had the same political ideology." I looked at him, I stared at him, as you know, a rational person would, and I said, "No, are you kidding me?" And he insisted on it, and I said, "You can insist all you want. I'll walk out of here before I put my name to something so stupid." Now, you would think that with his reputation, I would have been fired right there, but that was not the case. I explained to him in some detail, and he listened to me, why that was ridiculous. And he argued with me. Eventually, he dropped it. The point I'm trying to make is that he, while not being an academic himself, he recognized the ability in others. And he was aware when he made an error and had no problem in admitting that. So that has to be a part of his legacy as well. And he's been one of the few men in history to create and finance a substantial institution where you could have scholars like me who were in, at least in academia, on the fringes, and give them a place where they could be free, a place where they can work and not be harassed by the regime. Now, some people might ask how I got through two graduate degrees, a master's degree from St. Louis and a doctorate degree from Nebraska. And the answer is, I think there's not much they could have done with me. They liked me on a personal level, which is important. They knew me personally before they got an idea of what I was philosophically. I was working in three departments, history, political science, and philosophy there in Nebraska, so I was all over the place. And because they liked me personally, and I knew that I was in such a minority that I had to make myself as likable as possible, once I began speaking about the things that we talk about here, it was fairly, it didn't take long. They were able to accept it and deal with it without too much. I mean, I was seen more of an eccentric than anything else. And also, you know, so I got through that, my examinations and dissertation. My dissertation was on Professor Michael Oakeshott. Essentially, it was the idea of how language is manipulated in times of revolution. And I used his experience and its modes specifically. His own dissertation in 1933 to ground that. So technically, the degree is in the history of political philosophy, So already in the degree, it includes three departments. And so I had an overloaded, an oversized committee, including the famous Nelson Potter, who I don't even know what he is politically. He's passed on now. He was one of the kindest and most generous men I've met in academia, and that's very rare. He was a humongous man. He was 6'7", about 500 pounds at least, and but a very gentle giant. And he passed away a few years ago, far older than I ever thought he would make it. But all of that is very important. You need to understand that, you know, I suffered. I fought my way through those degrees. There were a lot of people. David Forsyth, for example, who was a chairman of the department in Nebraska at the time, who was a so-called dean of the human rights studies area, who wanted me out. And he would call this you know, master of free speech, and he would make these impassioned arguments for openness, would call secret meetings where no one but faculty were allowed, demanding my ouster. And people who knew me would say, well, on what grounds? And it was strictly ideological. And said, well, we can't do that. We won't do that. We're not getting rid of a talented people because you don't like them. And I was the only one who he did that with. And it shows you, and I learned very quickly, how fraudulent and how ridiculous academia is and the lives that these people live. But it's an easy gig. They have, most of them are six figures. They have tenure, so they have 100% job security. They could do whatever they want in the summers. They teach very little, especially once they get tenure. So much of their research is done by others and written by others. Every paper that you write for a professor can be used in their own research. That's not copyrighted, so they could use whatever they want. And they have access to many female students and grad students, and that, of course, is notorious in academia. It's a really, really nice gig. And I have heard too many times after a few beers, these guys say that we'll pretty much do anything and say anything to have a job like this. Now, these days, those jobs are almost impossible to find. There was this explosion of people going back to college starting maybe 2003, when the online things began exploding, and it just, you know, everyone was going back to school. About 3 or 4 years ago, that ended. And as always, universities behaved irrationally. They overspent, they overborrowed, and they put that money to anything but education. They were putting it to dormitories and cafeteria, completely remaking their computer mainframes, everything but actually hiring professors. Because especially amongst small institutions like Mount St. Mary's, it's a niche market to begin with, and the competition is ferocious. And these people are under the impression that no one is really there for education. What they're there for is an easy life. And they're putting their money to that kind of thing. And now that has that student increase is now way down. A lot of schools are now at, you know, 80-70% of their former capacity, and they're left with this huge debt. And the problem is that none of this ever went to hiring academics. None of this ever went to anything that had anything to do with education. And I'm gratified when people tell me that listening to these broadcasts is a lot like going back to college, just without the ignorance and the PC. I have taught at four universities in my career. My student evaluations were always at the top 1% of every one. I'm very proud of that. Students love me. And students love me partially because I was very edgy. I went in there and I said things that they never heard before. You know, and it got me into a lot of trouble. What works with students, the people who are actually paying the bills, and the people the institution is there for, doesn't work for professors. Professors are hired and promoted based on one thing, and that is their desire, their ability to fit in with other professors in other departments, and that is almost always ideological. And again, I did well only because I was a nice guy and people liked me, but every once in a while, you know, I'd have a confrontation with someone who would say something in public very stupid, and I thought it was my professional duty to correct them. And my professional duty apparently is not in their interests. And I was always in trouble with somebody. And I'm very proud of that. but it did cost me quite a bit professionally. I have put together a decent income from writing and translating, and that's made it possible for me to make ends meet without ever having to conform myself to the system, and I'm also very proud of that. These broadcasts, they exist for one reason, that both orthodoxy, in terms of it, you know, the theology and the ethics, on the one hand, and the nationalism as a political and ethical system, have to be explained and defended competently. That's the only reason that I'm on this planet. That's the only reason I'm doing any of this. When I'm involved in debates over these questions, it could be religious, it could be about a historical question, World War II or whatever it is, 99% of my time is being used to dispel the myths that they have about what actually happened. It isn't so much that they dislike Christianity. They don't know what it is. And they somehow along the line, they've gotten some very stupid ideas of what Christians believe, of any denomination. Historical myths are taught in the academy as fact, and you better not disagree with them. Now, I personally have never met a university professor who would hurt a student for saying the wrong thing on an exam in terms of ideologically being not PC. Now, that was a long time ago. Things may have changed. I was scrupulous about it. Now, I know that exists in some places. I have not come across it myself. Many professors are actually pretty scrupulous about making sure that those considerations don't go into grading, although these days, given what's happened in academia, I think those days are long over. There was a reason that I was very popular, and there's also a reason why these broadcasts have done very well. And I keep saying this, and I still don't understand why these broadcasts have been so successful, by far the most influential thing I've ever done. And I thank all my listeners for that. I still don't get it, but I think it has something to do with what I just said, bringing these ideas and explaining to the world these concepts in a way that ordinary people can understand. Academics can be very difficult for people who are not trained in it. There's a specialized language and a way of speaking and a way of writing that really makes it completely inaccessible to other people. This is a big problem. The Bible, for example, the words of Jesus don't make any sense unless you read the prophets first. Jesus assumes that his readers have read the prophets, or at least know the story. He assumes this, given where the time and place where he's speaking. When you read the church fathers, St. Basil or St. Augustine or Ambrose, for example, they assume that their readers are familiar with Plato and Aristotle, that they know the technical definitions of terms like a form or matter or accident or substance. If you're not familiar with these terms, if you don't know what they are in a technical, ontological sense, then don't read them. Because when you start reading them, you're going to think that they mean something else if you understand them at all. Same thing with the American Founding Fathers. These guys were trained and essentially in Greco-Roman political categories. If you don't know that, and if you don't know what they mean by certain things, if you don't know the technical definition of terms like constitution and law, which were different back then than what they are now, then learn what they are first and then start reading them. You can't just pick these people up. You can't simply pick St. Basil up and expect him to speak to you. He was not speaking to you. He was speaking in a very different time, using a highly technical vocabulary that require a tremendous knowledge of ancient Greek philosophical thought, as well as a knowledge of the historical context, all of which he assumed his readers had. Now, I have an article on my website, rustjournal.org, concerning the name-worshipping heresy. My personal opinion is that this is a much ado about nothing. The notion that there are people out there who believe that the vibrations caused by speaking a word or the ink that forms letters on a page are in fact God or anything else, they don't exist. There's no such entity out there. No one believes this. The problem is that when you deal with a name-worshipping issue, you're dealing with really some of the deepest metaphysical and ontological speculation out there, not to mention linguistic philosophy, all of which are highly technical areas that take a lot of time to master. This is what I did in college and grad school, and so I was in a perfect position to start reading the Church Fathers afterwards, because you realize, you know, they're using terms that come directly from Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, Proclus, etc. If you don't know who those people are, or you don't know what they meant, then please don't read St. Basil. What ends up happening, both in the name-worshipping thing as well as just patristics in general, what ends up happening is people just use these guys to find ammunition against their opponents. And they'll try to find a sentence here or a word there or a slogan there that could be used, possibly interpreted, to mean that their opponents are wrong about something. And that is not the way any of this can be done. That is not what the Church Fathers were written for. The words, and it's been one of the biggest problems in my career, words don't mean the same today as they meant 100 years ago, let alone in ancient times, let alone through translation. Concepts like a form and matter and law and force and science and idea, concept, these things didn't mean the same then as they do now. And they certainly were used even then in a highly technical way. And so you have to, you know, you have to go into this already educated in the field, and then you start reading these guys. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of people in Orthodoxy right now who have this ability, who have this training. And so the name worshiping issue has become a disaster. It's torn churches apart, largely based on the fact that the people involved don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand the concept of word, idea, referent in a Platonic or Neoplatonic context. They believe somehow that Neoplatonism was rejected, in fact, anathematized by the Orthodox Church. And what it refers to is the sort of magical incantations that certain of the more bizarre Neoplatonists were using, having nothing to do with Plato at all. Plato is absolutely essential for a knowledge of Christianity at one level or another. I was a Platonist before I was a Christian. And when I read The Republic, I was 17. I read The Republic for the first time, and I never, it struck me like any piece of music can, like any work of art can. It was intuitive to me. It made sense to me. And I was never the same. Going from Plato's theory of the forms to Christ, his logos, is not really hard. And St. Justin Martyr is one of these people who made that very same jump. Plato is essential for an intellectual knowledge of Christianity, far more so than Aristotle. So, with that introduction, we're going to talk about today an economist, someone who unfortunately doesn't exist at all in English. Now, I have taught myself Russian. I don't think I'm all that good. I could read it, but speaking it is out of the question. I could read these as words on a page, and I can translate Russian into English. But in terms of communication, that's verbal communication, and it's really out of the question. The man is Vladimir Katasonov, and he is absolutely essential, very, very famous in Russia right now, as being one of the economists, really one of the theorists of the war against the New World Order, globalization. Globalization is, I've said many, many times, we'll say many times in the future, is the political and economic expression of Antichrist. It is the manifestation of Satan in the world. Antichrist, it can be used in one of two ways. It can be used in such a way as to refer to someone who dislikes and denies Christ. All of those people would be Antichrists. But the Antichrist, with a capital T and a capital A, refer to this particular person or personality that will come to power in the last days. He will have global importance. He will have absolute power. He will be very close to the Jews, if not a Jew himself. I'm not so certain it has to be a person. I think it could be an institution or a group of people who are so like one another in their basic fundamentals that they function as a single person. I'm not so sure that, a single person can rule in the same way that an institution can. It's so much easier to personify a person than it would be something as complicated as a New World Order. You can't personify the New World Order. There are no formal institutions. It's really a series of attitudes of dominant powers working in a loose confederation, mostly economic, for economic gain. But it should, you know, it should be borne in mind when you deal with the New World Order and globalization, the people who are forcing this on people already are the wealthiest, most powerful people the world has ever known. Modern technology has made totalitarianism possible. That kind of life was impossible prior to the 20th century. You can have tyrannical leaders, you can have authoritarian leaders, you couldn't have totalitarian leaders. The very existence of mass media makes everything completely different today than it was in the ancient world. The church fathers, except in, you know, some of these more bizarre mystical experiences that some of them may have, had no conception of this. The closest they could come to is the old Atlantean civilization of Nimrod in Babylon. That did have global power. That was a high-tech civilization. It was a civilization based on some kind of positivist science. Not a whole lot is known about it because it was destroyed. Almost every civilization in the world has some kind of a flood story suggesting to me that it happened. I've always been very impressed by the fact that there's always this golden age, and then it was destroyed, usually by some human arrogance, you know, some decay that was built into the system, that the system was then destroyed and everything radically altered. Most of your occult groups, Masonic groups, and I'm using those terms broadly, believe that they are carrying on the wisdom that was encoded into the myths of what we call paganism. The Atlantic civilization, the civilization that came out of Babylon, Nimrod, this idea of a high-tech society that was not only believing that it was superior to the natural order, but it can replace the natural order. That human reason, and I mean specifically the mentality or the demands of the elite, could be translated into science and thereby translated into technology, such that nature is then superfluous. This is what makes, say, the late Renaissance in the West different from any other time in human history. Why didn't ancient China, ancient Greece, ancient Rome ever develop the mentality of the high-tech system we have today? There was never any interest in this. You know, technology was impressive, but it never was. It never reached the point of the industrialized system that started to exist in 19th century England. Not even close. And the mentality that would have created that didn't exist either. But it can't be because the science was primitive, the knowledge, the mathematics was primitive. It wasn't. Their medicine was substantial. Their life expectancy was no different than ours, probably a little higher. No one in the world can believe that they were less happy than moderns are. Chances are they were far happier. What was different about the West that industry came out of it? Industry is a completely different phenomenon. When I say industry, I'm not talking about I'm talking about mass production. I'm talking about the mills the idea that nature is flawed and science can then be used to create technology. And that technology will solve those flaws and make man's life easier, better, more productive. Vladimir Katasonov has written a lot. Most of what he deals with is contemporary issues. Russia against the New World Order is essentially his main concern, but he is trained as an economist and deals with all aspects of that. But a topic that he deals with not too often, but when he does it, you should listen, is the origin of the money economy And he means this not just in terms of the historical development, but also the mentality, the ideology. What was it about the West that created the mentality of industrialization that existed in no other civilization, no matter how scientifically advanced they became? And that's what he refers to as the society of Atlantis, that eventually had a successor state in Nimrod, in Babylon, the first empire of a global scope. Kadasonov has a book, Capitalism and Monetary Civilization, that I've translated. And his thesis is that the Atlantic idea, the Atlantean idea, is the essence of industry and commerce in the sense that we know it today. And never before in history has it reached this level, qualitatively and quantitatively. Industry is one thing, but the mentality and the ideas that underscore it, the nominalist notion of there being no inherent meaning in nature, in the created order, that's something fairly new. He believed that the first empire was dedicated to the pagan god Marduk. Now, I want to be careful here. There's no question that Marduk was a so-called patron god of Babylon. But I want to be careful in a couple of areas here. I don't believe that there's ever such a thing as paganism. There is no catechism of the pagans. There is no inquisition of the pagans. There is no theology that they have. It's really what we consider anything that is pre-Christian. It's really a meaningless term. The unfortunate problem that historians have is that these gods and goddesses and the rituals that surrounded them have the same terms that we use in the Christian, say, or the Islamic world. The word God doesn't apply to Marduk in the same way that it would Yahweh or Allah. None of these gods in the ancient world were created. Matter was seen, generally speaking, as eternal, and they were architects. The Demiurgos, which Plato speaks of, which is throughout the pagan world, is that these people arranged the matter that had always existed in a special way. Now, they had this ability to put it together, but this demiurge is always imperfect. There is no perfect, all-powerful gods in any of the pagan ideas. They're not gods. Now, we use the term God to refer to this all-powerful creator. That concept didn't exist. So using the word God is equivocal. It's very confusing, and it's often used for propaganda purposes. I think it's better to refer to them as heroes or archetypes. They were never meant to be worshipped as real things. Now, I'm sure the simple people most certainly did. But I could picture, you know, 1,000 years from now, a historian trying to figure out American society and talking about the religion of the average American and having, you know, celebrities and, you know, Superman and Batman as part of this pantheon of this polytheistic society. That would make more sense. The concept of what Superman is or Batman is to us, why it's lasted as long as it has, why it speaks to people, not just kids. That's not a religious concept. It's a cultural concept, and it's a social concept. But that's pretty much what they meant when they referred to their pantheon of gods and goddesses. They were ideas. They were aspects of the society or the natural order that were important to them. And these stories are the mentality, the constitution, in the true sense of the word, of these ancient societies. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of these. I've read them, until they were coming out my pores. They're usually fragmentary. And they're using terminology that moderns simply don't understand. To call, you know, Marduk God in the same sense we call Yahweh God is very confusing and really doesn't help anybody. And if that's how you start your research, you're in trouble right away. They were not meant to be believed as literal beings on Mount Olympus. You know, Hesiod, when he was gathering the traditions that had been around in his day, didn't believe that he was writing their biographies. Ovid the same way in Rome. He is putting together in some kind of rational way how these societies understood themselves. They were social virtues. They were archetypes in the true sense of the word. And in a society like that, you know, the poetic, qualitative way of thinking was dominant. They didn't have this obsession with quantity that moderns have. Another thing that irritates me, people who pretend to know something about the New Testament or the Old Testament, when they refer to numbers as just numerals, 1, 2, 3, and 4, I roll my eyes. They don't realize that these numbers weren't numbers. They were icons. The numbers were qualitative icons. They were very deep. They expressed tremendous meaning. So number 1, for example, referred to unity. It was always masculine. It was always the father. It was always the primordial, the foundation, substance. That's what they meant by the number 1. And numbers throughout, from 1 to 9, were similarly understood. They had genders. They had social functions. It didn't necessarily mean 2 or 3 of something. And certainly that was the case in the Bible. These numbers are sacred. These numbers refer to a qualitative reality. Now, it's not to say that there weren't 12 apostles. It is to say, though, that 12 is not an accidental number. 2 is not an accidental number for Christ's nature. I mean, these are chosen for a very specific reason. The number 4 is a number of death. 4 is a number of signs in a square. It's a prison cell. It's always a horrible number. So Moses wasn't literally in the desert for 40 years. It just meant that they were in this horrible condition of rootlessness and alienation for a long period of time. The number 4 is invoked for that reason. So when he says that Babylon was dedicated to Marduk, it says a lot about what kind of society that was. It was dedicated to Marduk in the same way that America is dedicated to George Washington. Doing the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning for school kids is not a religious exercise, although the way present historians write, it would be. These weren't religions. Paganism has no doctrine. And these weren't real beings. They were never supposed to be real beings. They are part of the constitution of these societies. And they are poetic and artistic representations, what was important to these societies. Marduk is the same person as Baal. Baal is more of a title than a name, and it refers to the landlord. It refers to the lord of a specific area, ownership. Marduk was the god associated with magic. The shovel, the spade, which is very important, building something. He was both good and evil, which is very common in paganism. There was no such concept as good or evil. They were understood relatively. He was a demiurge, the demiurgos. He was not a creator, but he was the prime arranger of primordial matter in such that he created the present cosmological order. And since he's not perfect, that present order is flawed. Some have claimed that he was the same as Poseidon, the founder of Atlantis. And his claim is, and understand this, Baal was the mentality of the elite. Any oligarchy has Baal or Marduk as their patron, so to speak. That's the mentality. That's the idea. Money is a spiritual idea, among other things. Babylon, Atlantis, these were global in scope. For the first time, we have a global empire. The New World Order is completely global. The first time in the history of man since Babylon. These were based on technology in the sense this was a way that the elite could dominate others. It wasn't about saving labor. We call these things, you know, labor-saving devices. And everyone knows that no one is more overworked than Americans. A labor-saving device just means that expectations for those using them are higher. If someone in an office building, you know, gets a new machine to get something done quickly, it just means they have more work to do in the course of a day. This is the idea. This is, you know, Atlantis was a civilization that was destroyed. This is what God destroyed. We refer to things like, refer to people as titans of industry. The word titan comes up over and over. Yes, it refers to, you know, mythical giants, It also refers to people who are like giants, who are dominant in a particular area. Titans are oligarchs. In the beginning of time, this is how oligarchs were seen. They have always existed, and their antitype is a spiritual monarchy. So when Sigmund Freud refers to the death of the father, he's talking about the common good. When the father is killed, the sons do as they please. They live for themselves. And in Russian history and in most history, the universal constant is that there is a war going on between the common good, the spiritual end of man, and the passions, the drives, the appetites. Oligarchy on one side, monarchy on the other. That's pretty much the two choices that humanity has. This is the idea of the Talmud. Jews in Babylon absorbed this magical idea. Magic is connected with technology. What the ancients meant by magic, we refer to as technology. It's the same sort of thing, only now we can rationalize it, and we don't put a face to it. Everything is quantitative. The minute you give something a personality in modern times, it becomes a myth. In order to exist in the scientific mind, it can't have a personality, it can't be a person. The minute a personality or a purpose is introduced, it becomes myth and therefore non-scientific. Now, what does this mean in more practical day-to-day terms? Katasonov argues that the market is a fraud. Ideologies like this really are means to justify a certain power relation. Ideologies are very different from principles. A Christian monarchy, spiritual monarchy, an ideal state, Plato's philosopher king, for example, is based around the idea of truth and the common good. The titan, the oligarch, is based on the idea of the private good, the idea of freedom of contract, not bothering to notice that some people have a lot more power than others, and therefore some people's freedom can be used to great effect. Other people's freedom can be used to no effect. That's the hoodwink. That's the fraud. The French Revolution is based on the idea of individualism, that each individual should be abstractly free to pursue what they want. And since there's no real purpose to man or to anything, what they want is really defined as something that doesn't harm anybody else, and no one really knows what harm is. The conclusion, though, the practical outlook is that those who already have power require that kind of ideology to justify what they're doing. Because if you pursue your own interests as a nobody, and Warren Buffett pursues his own interests as one of the most powerful men in the world, there's a big difference in what happens. But if that's all you believe in, and Warren Buffett does something, if he buys up your land or whatever it is, you're in no position to complain because you're pursuing the exact same thing that he is. The fact that he's more powerful than you is not his problem. If all there are individuals, and the only good is when we pursue our self-interest, then those with power will rule without any ethical restraint. And that's what modernity is. That's what the market is. When this was imposed on Russia in between 1990 and 1992, largely by foreigners, Harvard University, the American State Department, people locally, at Gaidar and Yeltsin, those who already had power simply took over the Russian economy. They used the so-called market to aggrandize themselves. They already had power. Someone who's a nobody had no wherewithal to know what to do as an individual in the market. They had very little information, and they were very easily manipulated out of whatever share that they may have had in the societies as a whole. They received these vouchers for a certain percentage of the economy, and it's very easy to make those worthless, very easily for an oligarch to take those, to render those null and void, to trick them out of their holders. And this has always been the case. Whenever a market is imposed on a society, all it means is that those who already have access to power now control everything. Now, we need to remember as a historical fact, there was never a time where capitalism was national or local. Capitalism and industry came into existence because imperialism already existed. Industrialization required a huge amount of excess funds, of excess liquidity to create. A massive amount of it. Where did that come from? Well, it came through imperialism. It came through the silver that was being brought to America to Europe by the Spanish, by the exploitation of peoples, especially in Ireland and India. That excess value was brought back to Europe, and that alone gave the excess funds necessary to create what we now call industrialization. Imperialism and internationalism was absolutely required for there to be these huge factories. That kind of excess funds isn't just automatically generated by a society. It has to come from without. And the only thing that could do it so quickly is the silver found in the Americas, in South America in particular, and the excess funds and the excess money with jewels, anything else that came from the colonization of the Far East, selling drugs to the Chinese, and manipulating the labor of these millions of people who had no way to fight back. This is where industry came from. That's where the initial capital came to invest and to create these monstrous factories. So when Henry VIII and his successors secularized the church and took all of that land owned by the monasteries and parishes, he then created a land market. He created, among other reasons, created a money economy. And all of this joined together to create an oligarchy that then slowly developed the ideology to justify it in William of Orange, international commerce, usury, and then industry. There had to be a mass dispossession, not just of Englishmen or Germans or Dutch, but of the peoples of the planet before you had all of that liquidity necessary to create the massive factories we all know today. Now, that's very simplistic and squished down into a few sentences, but that's the process. So the enclosures were ways that the English elite could use the wool trade with the in union with the Italian bankers in northern Italy to bring in a tremendous amount of liquidity to England. That's just one small aspect of a huge process, and it meant the exploitation of peasants the world over. Exploitation is simply taking from these people far more than they were given. The ultimate is slavery. And slavery is a big part of where this excess liquidity came from. Anybody who works without being paid or being paid a very tiny amount is a slave. So someone who is in debt, especially if it's not their fault, and 90% of their time is working to pay someone else off, it's a slave by definition. I don't care what legal label you give it. That's what condition these people are in. Usury is absolutely necessary to capitalism, because credit is necessary for capitalism. A country goes to war, something like World War I, for example. No one ever expected the mass carnage that occurred. But that mass carnage came into existence because of the tremendous scientific investment in things like the machine gun, the tank later on, air power, poison gas, the Mauser rifle, the grenade. These things were the development of industry. And one of the things that industry was used for was to buttress the power of the elite by creating these weapons of warfare. Now, for a country to go into war, no matter how wealthy they are, it requires a massive expenditure. That means they have to go to the bankers. That means that the bankers are benefited greatly. Anytime there's this need for cash, especially if it's a very fast need for cash. When a country is dependent on something, that means they're in a position of weakness relative to that something. The rich are being borrowed from rather than taxed. That's the issue. This is how oligarchies rule. States are not very important only because they are dependent on banks. Everything has been financialized. Therefore, everything is dependent on a handful of banks. And banks, when they lend out money, unless it's Ukraine, it's not done for no reason. It's done only when they are inspecting and approve a certain investment course. So banks not only control the money and control where that money goes, but they are on a day-to-day level in control of how it's invested. They control an economy. So to say that somehow a state can regulate the banks is ridiculous. It's the other way around. It's been proven over and over again that governments and politicians are essentially window dressing. When a government is totally dependent on an institution like a bank to function at all, especially when it's indebted to the U.S., it means that the bank rules. Now, oligarchy is essential to capitalism. In Catasano's view, it's essential to all modernity. Because any time you allow the rich to prosper, and the rich do not refer to those who have worked hard for what they've done. Those in the banking industry do not work. They do not create. They rely on taking from those who actually do create. And those who do create are not paid nearly as much as those who live off of them. One of the essential aspects of usury is parasitism. They're a parasite. It's a negative phenomenon. They exist by exploiting, living off of the labor of others. Cicero referred to natural law as never prospering at the expense of someone else. It's a negative formulation. If you receive some sort of income at someone else's expense, it becomes not really income, but rather a rent. But this is how the banks function. Their interest rate exists because there's nowhere else to go. They use their position of absolute dominance to control society, and since there's nowhere else to go, anything over and above profit for them becomes a rent. Lawyers function this way. You know, if you get arrested for something, you're so scared, you'll pay them anything to get you off. That's what a rent is. It's any use of political power, social power, cultural power to extract income that otherwise they would not have. That is capitalism, that is profit, that is rent. Usury is essentially a condemnation of rents. But we're dealing with the secularization, the piracy, looting, the slave trade, all of these things in early modern society are at the foundation of the creation of industry. But usury has to be essential, and not just referring to interest. The fact that once an oligarchy is created, all that really matters is that since there's no alternative, anything that they make is coercive. Any money that they make becomes a rent. And we often don't use rent that way, and that's not an accident. But this was known in ancient Israel, and the prophets, to a man, condemned this violently. The church fathers condemned this violently. And yet this doesn't come up very much in canonical discussions. For, I think, very good reason, in the minds of these people, sexual sins are far more important than the economic sins, which certainly aren't the case. Far more harm is done with the one than the other. Not to say that sexual sins aren't a problem, just that they have substituted for sin in general. People make a big deal about these kinds of sexual sins, or heresy, or schism, or something like that, anger, issues like that, violence. But somehow, usury, profit, rent, these aren't talked about at all. And yet the prophets of the Old Testament spent an awful lot of time condemning them. In fact, it was the essence of their, the non-theological essence of their message. The Old Testament prophets laid out what the foundational ideas of a Christian politics is. And Katasonov and so many others have made that essential. Why didn't Christ develop a political theory? Why didn't he talk about politics or ethics? He did very rarely. It's because he assumed that his readers knew the prophets intimately. That's the culture that he was a part of. The prophets were almost totally political. They equated usury and rent with heresy. They believed that there was no distinction between worshiping Baal and extracting rent from peasants. The prophets were nationalist in terms of very ethnically oriented, that Israel should be a people set apart, and socialist in the sense they were very egalitarian. And it wasn't even so much that the state should be involved in that. In fact, the state really is a creation of oligarchy. For them, it was the law of God. In the Jubilee year, every 50 years, the clock should be set to zero. or anything developed, any profit, anything should then be completely reset. All families go back to where they were, and anything excess equalized amongst the initial founding families of Israel. Everything is canceled. All debts are canceled. And any slavery, servitude, any of that, is they're all freed. It's all over. You start from zero. In 1861, Emperor Alexander II signed a piece of paper that said serfs of the Russian Empire are now free. That's all he needed to do. When they had to pay back, to some extent, they had to pay back their landlord for that money, for that land that they received. They couldn't pay it, and so Alexander III canceled it. He signed another piece of paper and didn't have to pay this anymore. In other words, the crown had more power than the oligarchs. Oligarchs always exist. But a political system is legitimate only when the common good and the coercion behind the common good is more powerful than the private good. There is no common good in the United States. Vladimir Putin in Russia is successful because he has more power than the oligarchs, even all of them put together. He needs to be an oligarch himself in order to have the power to shut them up if necessary. That's the nature of politics. That's the nature of the common good. The Russian monarchy was always more powerful than the oligarchy. Otherwise, it had no reason to exist other than window dressing. They could decide whether serfs are free or not, and how much they have to pay and when. And when they couldn't pay it anymore, they canceled the debt. It would be very easy right now to solve the American debt problem by simply forcing credit card companies and everybody else to cancel American debts. If they're in trouble, well, so what? A lot of these guys go bankrupt, so what? Just a few years ago, American bankruptcies were 500,000 a month. If these people suffer, the economy suffers, big deal. The American economy is an absolute disaster right now because of this. This is the nature, though, of capitalism. Capitalism, as a spiritual idea, is the dominance of appetite over reason. Private good over the public good. Oligarchy over monarchy. An American politician, an American president can't do anything of himself. Putin, however, is completely free. He can do what he pleases, and this is what makes him effective, and this is what makes him popular. He is not a slave to the oligarchy. Every society has an oligarchy, not quite as powerful as the American, but it wasn't that long ago when the American political ruling class was referring to the oligarchs in Russia as the beacons of freedom, that this was democracy. And this is why Russians hate the concept of democracy, because they know it's largely an economic rather than a political category. We started off here by saying that the market is a fraud. It is. The market is something that is created rather than responded to. People buy what they're told. Most of what's bought is unnecessary. Most labor in American life is absolutely unnecessary. Whenever wants begin to increase, whenever the opportunity for greater and greater luxury hits a society, prosperity, in other words, people become debased. Not to say that poverty is this wonderful thing, but poverty is very relative. Anytime that the absolute necessities of life can't be had, you have true poverty. But that's not how Americans define the term. Prosperity is just as bad as poverty in terms of brutalizing the population. In Russia, at the time of Peter the Great, the desire for Western goods, Western luxuries began to grow in the ruling class. That's the only time that serfdom became a problem, because serfs were now used as slaves. They never were before. They were worked and worked and worked because what the ruling class wanted was Western goods, Western ideology, Western ways of thought. And that means that the serfs had to work harder and harder for that. We're in the exact same position. And the problem is that the American expectation of what prosperity is so great that the debt apparently is worth it. The great danger that we face is that the only asset that the U.S. has is the fact of its market. the fact that Americans will spend irrationally. The private sector debt is as large as a public sector debt. This fact is not spoken of, but it's extremely important. The public sector debt is about $18 trillion total in terms of the government, state governments, and the federal governments. The private sector debt, the corporate and individual, is about $15 trillion. It's almost as large. And that's not taking into advantage or into consideration compound interest in the future. So it's much, much higher than that. But as it stands right now, those are the numbers. With debt that high, there can be no recovery because no one can spend any money. That's it. It's reached its limit. The end is coming. It has to come because I took mathematics in college and I know how numbers work. That's all you have to know. There's no money to spend because the debt is simply too high. And because of that, America has lost its primary asset, which is its irrational customers. What's going to happen when China no longer cares whether or not Americans buy its products? The U.S. will be of no interest to it. Buying up America, financing America's debt will no longer be in its interest. People, the end is coming. It's coming quickly. People like Katasonov have been warning us. I've been warning us. It's very difficult to wrap your head around this. No one wants to hear it, but it's true. I'm at a point now where I'm defining truth as that which people don't want to hear. When I was in college, I had this naive view that if I had the facts at my disposal and could put it in a rational and intelligent way in conversation or writing it down, that people would convert. Not right away, but they would have to think it over. But that assumes that people care. People don't care about what the truth is. They care about what serves their interest. They want to hear what they want to hear, not what the truth is. So I win debate after debate after debate, thinking that that actually matters. It doesn't. For most people, truth is their enemy, and they don't care anyway. Truth is not the issue. Their self-interest is what matters. That's what happens when the private good controls the public good. I've gone a bit over my time. I know we've been all over the place on this. But this kind of economic approach is absolutely essential because the New World Order is essentially, at root, an economic phenomenon. I want to thank my listeners. As always, I thank my enemies. Stupid though you are, you do keep me on my toes. And I thank my opponents, even those who are on my side, who also keep me on my toes, because believe it or not, I am not infallible. My website is russjournal.org. Used to be .com years ago, but it's just Russ, as in R-U-S, then journal, J-O-U-R-N-A-L, .org. Most of my recent work is on there. And the and also barnesreview.org, the blog will also have a lot of my material there. And I strongly, strongly urge you to subscribe to the Barnes Review. It's stuff there that you cannot find anywhere else. It's a peer-reviewed academic material. A lot of what you find for free online is not worthwhile. That's why it's free. So I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.